So when I was like 12 or 13, I got to do 1 week where you like try different things. And I went to a kitchen and it was nice. But I found out there that the thing I liked about cooking was to eat what I cooked. So I found out there that I didn't want to be a chef and cook for other people. I wanted to cook for me. That's what I liked about it and like the people I care about.
I'm around 100 kilos of chocolate every single day and more than 100 kilos of sugar every day. I'm a pastry chef and sugar is my bread and butter and jam and Nutella. But I've decided to take those layers off with my brand new show. I'm talking to fellow chefs, entrepreneurs, my friends and mentors about the blood, sweat and all the other ingredients that go into making it in the food industry. I'm Pooja Dhingra and you're listening to my podcast, No Sugarcoat. On today's episode, I'm talking to author and home cook Nadine Redzepi in Denmark. Married to Noma's Rani Redzepi, Nadine has cooked for some of the best chefs in the world at home. She serves up some of her favorite family recipes in her new book, Downtime, Deliciousness at Home. So I've clearly been stalking you, Nadine. I've been stalking you for the last couple of weeks. So I got the book and I read it and it's incredible. And I want you to tell me about Seal the Deal Pasta.
Yes. So that was the first thing Renee cooked for me. When we met, when I started working at Noma as a waitress, everyone who started working there would get like a staff manual. And there was quite the chapter on staff not dating each other. And it was preferred that one of the people would leave the restaurant if you started dating, because it can create some chaos. So when Renee and I started seeing each other, we kept it a secret for quite a while.
Wow.
I think we thought that we kept it a secret for like 4 months, but maybe it was more like 1 month before everyone knew, but no one said anything. So we started in September, and the first time Renee cooked for me was in December. So I was very excited to I'd seen him cook at the restaurant before, so I knew that he could cook, but I was excited to see
what he would do
at home. Exactly. And what he would cook when he was going to cook something for me.
Yeah.
So the first thing he made was pasta, and it's pasta with a beurre blanc sauce and like peeled tomatoes. And I remember when he put it in front of me, I was like, that's it. somehow I was expecting more. I was like, really? That's it? Like pasta with some tomato? I could do that. But then I tasted it. And I remember everything just went completely quiet. And, my cheeks, they got all hot. And the top of my ears. And, it was so delicious. It was incredible. So
so you were like, this is the pasta that did the trick.
I was already there, but Renee likes to think that was the pasta that did the trick. So that's, he's actually the one that called it that.
Yeah, because so I need to find myself a Seal the Deal pasta man.
Yes.
That's what I need to look for. So Nadine, I want to get, talking a little bit about you, about, your childhood and how your food journey has been. So if you can just take me through that a little bit about where you grew up, how you got into food.
So my mother is Danish from a very small village in the outskirts of Denmark, and my father was born in London. My mother left to see the world and went to Paris as an au pair, where she met my father, who had run away from home to become a musician. So he was a street musician in the Latin Quarter in France.
No way.
And they fell in love. Yeah, they fell in love very quickly. And my mother is very small and my father is like 2 meters tall. So must have looked very funny.
So were you born in Paris?
No. I have a brother who's 8 years older than me. He was born in Saint-Tropez on a campsite where they lived. And they traveled all over the place, living by playing music. And then 8 years later, after my brother was born, seven years after he was born, they moved to Portugal my father's parents bought them a house with 4 acres of land in Portugal.
Wow.
So I was born in Portugal, and to save money, they grew everything themselves, or my mother did. So I didn't go to kindergarten or daycare or anything there. So I would spend like my days walking around, picking things, sewing things, feeding the animals that we had. We had everything there.
Wow. So really farm to table right from the beginning, huh?
Yes, exactly. So all of my like fondest memories from when we lived in Portugal, they're all connected to smelling something or feeling like the sun in the back of my neck while I'm eating pomegranates that are hot from the tree, or like eating buckets full of tomatoes. Like I would eat everything all the time.
And I'm sure the quality was just perfect.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, unfortunately my father, he had an alcohol problem. So eventually my parents, they split up, and my mother, she went back to Denmark with my brother and I.
Okay. And how old were you when you moved back to Denmark?
It was just before I turned 6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we moved back to Denmark and we had to learn how to speak Danish, and everything was very new and it's kind of a haze, but like my mom would cook every night, and that's like the strongest memories. And then my mother, she started working. She had these like late night shifts and 24-hour shifts. She worked at a refugee camp with young kids from Somalia, and my brother was supposed to babysit me, but he would go out.
So you were left to fend for yourself.
I was left alone in the kitchen, in the house. But I never wanted to just have a sandwich for dinner. It didn't feel real to me.
Yeah.
So I started from I was 6, I started making porridge, you know, standing on a chair on my knees. And then porridge turned into omelets where I would put all kinds of dried spices in it. It was awful sometimes, but I learned that young to observe what happens when you do this. And okay, interesting. If I don't do that, then this happens and it gets better. So I think omelets were actually my real entry into like really observing food when I cook it and noticing the differences and all these little things that make the whole difference. And then that gradually turned into roasting a chicken, something that's so simple, but it's so amazing.
I believe this roast chicken is very popular, huh?
Oh, my God. It's still my favorite thing. It's always been my favorite thing to eat. It's still every time we go traveling or anything and I come home, or when Renee goes traveling and he comes home after having been away for at least a week, I always make that. I feel like it's something you always want to eat.
Yeah, it's comfort.
Exactly. Like screams home.
Yeah. So you were, you know, learning how to cook for yourself and making yourself meals. So did you ever consider like, you know, taking food up professionally, or how did you end up being a waitress at 19? What took you there?
Well, so I was obsessed with cooking shows, and I would take notes watching cooking shows, and then I would practice and cook at home. And I really did think that I wanted to be a chef.
So that was an idea that you...
It was an idea. In Denmark, you have 3 times during your school, you have something called Career Week. So when I was like 12 or 13, I got to do 1 week where you like try different things. And I went to a kitchen and it was nice. But I found out there that the thing I liked about cooking was to eat what I cooked. So I found out there that I didn't want to be a chef and cook for other people.
You just want to cook for yourself.
I wanted to cook for me. That's what I liked about it, and like the people I care about.
Yeah.
So I decided I will continue to practice this thing, but it's not what I want to do for a living. So I ended up working as a waitress at Noma completely by coincidence. It almost didn't happen, actually. I was finishing my school, and I had just quit my job in the coffee shop so that I could focus on my exams, and then I was going to go traveling all over the world. And I get this call after I had just shopped and spent money that I really didn't have to spend. I bought some pants and stuff. And my phone rings, and there's this guy oh, can you come to NOMA? Can you work? And I'm like, I don't even know what NOMA is. Like, what's happening? Who are you? Why are you calling me? And while he's calling me, I mean, back then, it sounds crazy to say back then, there was this knocking function on the cellular phone. So I could hear that it was like knocking, and it was one of my girlfriends. And I was like, ah, she said that she worked at a place called Mona. Maybe that's something. I don't know. So I end up saying yes to taking the shift.
But how old was the restaurant then? Was it like a completely new restaurant, or was it?
It was like a year old.
Okay. And was it already famous or?
No, not at all. No. You know, the food scene in Copenhagen was quite small back then. So it was like very few people would follow. It has gotten a Michelin star already.
Yeah. And this was what, like 10 years ago, Nadine?
This is 13 and a half years ago.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So you asked, so you got that call and you asked your girlfriend, like, did she work at the same restaurant?
Back then, NOMA in the summertime, because NOMA was situated at the water, they would do this grill that they called Mona. It was like something cheap, but it was just something they did to try and get an extra revenue.
Yeah.
So, but she had never worked in the actual restaurant. She's like, oh my God, you're going there to work. It's like really fancy. They have really nice milk and like the water and like my finest dining experience. I mean, besides like home meals and stuff, but my finest dining out experience before that shift at NOMA was like a 2015 euro menu in France. So I remember, you know, I was fine. I was going to NOMA. I was like, I could totally run that coffee shop all by myself. I was totally fine. I was very confident that I would be okay.
Yeah.
So I went there and I just remember getting incredibly nervous as soon as I put my hand on the door handle. And then I walked through this door and like I was, you know, people were standing there polishing glasses and like polishing the cutlery. And I was fascinated, but also like, this is like a little much. Like, why do you need to do all this stuff? But the people that worked there were just so nice. And I thought it was amazing. My only task was to make sure that there was bread on people's tables and to set the table.
You know, that's a very important task, okay?
It is a very, very important job. Yeah. But I was like, seriously, you have one person just checking for water? Just put the bottles on the table. Like, what? You know, I've come a long way. I've come quite a long way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I actually think it's good sometimes that people question, like, why do we need to do this? Just because someone else says that you have to do this. No, but, I mean, I loved it. And I was back the next day and I was like, give me as many shifts as possible. I love this place. And, like, the food, like, all these things that were coming out of the kitchen with produce, like, green strawberries. I was like, what the hell? They're not even ripe. You know, like all these things that were so unknown and they were using all these weeds. It was incredible.
And then obviously you fell in love, I'm guessing.
And then, yes, I did. So back then, like all the way back then, the chefs and the waiters were a little more divided.
Okay.
Than they are now. And like now it's like one big team.
So wait, what's the policy on dating at NOMA now?
There are a lot of good couples have come out of NOMA. I'm not going to lie. A lot of good ones. Yeah. So, I mean, I think on that first day, on my first shift, there was a lot of information. Like I got a lot of things to remember. And I am sure, 100% sure that at one point, this guy had pointed to Renee and said, oh, that's the chef, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't take that in. So one of the things that I would do at NOMA to like break the ice when I was talking to people, I would be like, oh, how long have you been here? It was a good way to talk to people and start the discussion. So one day I go and they ask, oh, can you get linens on the fifth floor? And I was like, yeah, how do I get up there? I haven't been there before. The chef, one of the chefs, which just happened to be Renee, says, I'm going up there anyway, I'll show you. Okay, cool. So we're in the elevator and it seems like this elevator ride is taking forever and it's very quiet. So I look at him and I say, oh, how long have you been here? And he just looks at me and he's like, you're kidding, right? I don't know. I mean, He's like, you know, this is my place, right? Oh, great. So nice. And, you know, I remember I felt like my cheeks were on fire. And then, bing, we were there. And I said, oh, thank you for showing me this. I mean, obviously, I should have known that. So, and 2 weeks later, there was a staff party. And he threw a piece of bread at me. And that was it.
Aww. And yeah. So then you had to hide it. So I mean, you know, I want to get into your style of cooking, and I want to talk about the book and how that whole chapter of your life took place.
I think, so with my parents having been street musicians, and even after my parents split up, we, you know, my brother and I, we never had the fancy clothes or like the diesel jeans or like the newest toys or anything, but we always traveled.
Yeah,
a lot. There was never a single vacation where we were home. We were always out. So I've always traveled a lot. And I've always, since I was little, played this game with myself that when I eat something, I separate everything in my mouth and like think about, huh, what could I do with this? How would I like this better? And I do the same when I cook myself now, like, How would I make this better? Or when I go to a restaurant, if I eat something I really like.
So like you think of the different flavors that you're feeling, and then you kind
exactly,
of dissect them.
Always.
Okay.
So always, like everywhere I eat, I'm always like taking it apart.
Yeah.
Thinking about how will I like this better? How can I do this at home? How would this work? So it's really strange, like always thinking about food, actually. So I think just having traveled so much and eaten so many places,
yeah,
it gives you like this massive library of like food flavor to draw on,
yeah,
and ways of cooking. And I've always, for me, I hate this like authenticity thing. I hate that that's a thing, or it's not real Italian, or it's not real Spanish, or real, yeah, Japanese. Like when you're cooking at home and you don't have like some themed restaurant, can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I hate that people are like, oh, you can't do this. Like, of course, I can do whatever I want.
I'm going to eat it.
So, exactly. And it's really good.
Yeah. So, you know, you said you do cook a lot for yourself and that's what you enjoy and for the family. So
exactly.
Is that why you wanted to write the book, to just have like a collection of your recipes? Or
I think when you're pregnant for the first time, I think it's very normal that you think about your own childhood and,
yeah,
you start thinking about the things that you really liked or what you kind of wish you had had more of or some of when you were growing up.
Yeah.
And you start thinking about what type of parent you want to be. And one of the things that I was thinking of when I was pregnant was that despite the fact that Renee would probably always be working in the evening and wouldn't be eating with us, I wanted to sit down and have like a proper dinner every day,
yeah,
with this kid that would come to the world. And I always wished that I had like this recipe book that went all the way back to my great grandmother or something.
Yeah.
So I started writing down my favorite recipes to give to my kids. And that's actually what this book is. Renee would always say, oh, who knows, one day it'll be a real book. But, you know, as time went and I got better and better and better at cooking,
yeah,
he was like, you should really, like, this should be a book one day. And I was like, ah, that's what you do. You do these books and stuff. And, you know, people kept asking Renee, especially after the Noma book came out, oh, when will you do a Noma at home book?
Hmm.
And Renee said, I don't want to make a Noma at home book. I never cook at home. Nadine does all the cooking. I don't know any like chefs like this who actually cook at home. So this thing grew, and for a long time it just stayed in my head as a thing that was nice to think of. Like, oh, maybe one day I'll do a cookbook. Like, I didn't actually think I would ever do it. So Instagram came, or I realized Instagram.
It's a dark hole, Nadine. It's a dark hole, Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very dark hole. I started an Instagram account at the end of my pregnancy with our third daughter. So this, yeah, is, she's four, so this is like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So I started the Instagram account and just started posting some photos of what we eat and what I cook anyway. Because one of my issues with writing a cookbook was also the thought of making a book. Like, I would be the first person to roll my eyes if some famous chef's wife all of a sudden published a book. I'd be like, yeah, right. As if. It was important for me to, like, get it out there that I do cook.
Yeah.
To, like, everyone before I would do a book.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to, I mean, Instagram was great because I wanted, like, a little feeler to see, like, how will people respond to me cooking at home.
And I think it kind of shows people your personality as well, right? Because you get to see your style of food and, you know, what you're making with the children. I see, you know, on your stories at breakfast, everybody's cooking together. And I think it's a good, like, insight into actually what goes on.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's like I could solidify that it is real. So, you know, no one can roll their eyes and be like, oh, yeah, as if she cooks. Yeah, and then I was like, okay, you know, here in Denmark, we're so lucky, we have 1 year full paid maternity leave.
Wow.
It's amazing. So, you know, I got to, like, really think about how I would do this book, how I would attack it.
Yeah.
And so then once my maternity leave was over, I started working on the book pretty much full time.
You make it sound very easy. Huh? I'm, like, struggling and crying with mine. And this is like a podcast where we remove all the sugarcoat, like we don't sugarcoat anything. So I want to actually know, like, did you have, like, moments where you were like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Were you frustrated? Was there, like, did you ever feel like, you know, giving up? That laugh tells me yes. So.
Well, actually, I thought that the process of making a book and publishing a book, I think it's way too long. I think things move too slow. I get too impatient with it. Maybe it's because I chose to publish the book in America, first off, because I figured if I could sell the book to an American publisher, then surely other publishers would join in too. Whereas if it was a Danish book, a tiny little market, it would be more difficult to sell anywhere else. Mm. So, and I think the way the Americans do it, they plan so far ahead. So I had to write a proposal that was like 80 pages long to like send to the publisher that really felt like a book, you know? I didn't have like a timeline that I needed to finish. So I had the time to do it the way that I wanted to have it when I did this proposal. Yeah. And then when I met the publishers, they're like, okay, great. We want to publish it in 1.5 years. So I had so much time to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, the most frustrating thing is all this waiting, I think, which is annoying. When we shot the photos for the book, we did all of the photos in 8 days.
Yeah.
And I wanted to cook everything myself. I just had someone that came and did the dishes, but I wanted to do everything myself because it was important to me that when we did it, everything was real. And I thought, if I can do every single thing in this book in 8 days, then it works and it's easy enough.
Wow.
You know, sometimes when you do things and maybe sometimes in your sleep in the beginning when you open the cafe, and sometimes when you go to sleep, maybe you can still like see that you're making macaroons or something.
You know, yes, I felt like all the time
sleeping like, oh, cookie. How cooking? Or, oh my God, did I buy this?
Did you burn something?
Can't shoot it. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but I thought it was fun. I mean, the whole time I was like, I'm making the book. This is great. This is what I wanted.
But at any point, did you feel the pressure, like you said, you know, that people are going to think, oh, this is the wife of this famous chef. Like, was that a concern for you? Was that something that bothered you?
So the thing also with me wanting to make everything myself, I wrote everything in the book myself. I mean, I did everything in the book because I was a little defensive about it. Mm-hmm. Already. I was ready for people to be like critiquing me and stuff. Like I was ready. I was like, okay, throw it at me. Give it to me. I'm ready. So actually, I was so ready that I was actually almost disappointed
that
when the book came out and all these interviews and stuff, and no one asked me any like critical questions like this. I was like, come on. Yeah, well, I guess I was so prepared that somehow I'd really gotten it out there. So no one even asked me about it.
I met you, 2 years ago in India. And I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on India. Was that your first visit here?
So it was my first time in India, first time in Mumbai. For 4 days, we got to see and experience a lot of things. But it wasn't anywhere near enough time. Like, definitely need to go back. There's so much more I want to see. And also, like, more of India, not just Mumbai.
Yeah.
I think the food, like, the Indian food is absolutely incredible. And I think I haven't even, like, scratched the surface.
Yeah.
All, but, like, those long fermented rice rolls, pancake things. Oh, my God. It's so good.
I think the dosa, no?
The dosa, yeah. Yes. Oh, my God, I love those.
Have you ever tried to make anything inspired by your trip here?
Yes, actually. I tried to make the dosas. It didn't turn out, like, amazingly. But I think it's something I probably need to try a few times before I nail that, and I need to find the right pan to do it also.
Yeah.
I also made, which worked very well. We went to this place, and I don't remember the name, but they had, like, these buns or these rolls, very soft, milky, yeasty
buns. Like pao. Just,
yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That was great. The kids liked it with when they were hot, with butter and honey on.
Oh, my God. So you do cook with the kids a lot, right?
Yes, I do.
And
I do.
I can't even imagine what their palates are like.
Well, you know, surprisingly, I don't think they don't like everything. Like, I wish that they would just eat everything super happily.
They throw a fuss of what you make for them? They don't like what you cook for them?
Not always. Not always. I mean, I get that they have an issue with, like, super spicy food. That's the only time where I will actually cook something else for them.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I cook, you know, they eat what we eat. And if they don't like it, then, you know, unfortunately, they don't eat. So they always eat. But I think, you know, I think it's like this biggest mistake that I see, like, even very good friends do. Like, it's the worst thing. Like, if they say that they don't like it, it's like, oh, okay, let me make you some pasta with olive oil. You know, then they're never going to want to try things. So,
that's
like,
true.
Eat what's on the table. Or eat whatever you like that's on the table.
Yeah.
And then that's it. But our kids, they know and they understand that they need to try everything. Like, even, you know, if they think they don't like it, they know that they have to try things at least 20 times before they can officially say that they don't like it.
So what don't they like?
Well, so they all have, like, the worst thing for all of them is actually, like, cooked spinach, or, like, they don't like the texture.
And
like, they love to eat it raw.
Yeah.
But if I cook the spinach, which I love, it's like they all have this, like, gag reflex that kicks in.
So, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that'll change eventually.
But they've had it 20 times and now it's official. It's accepted at home.
Well, not yet. I have to say, with the spinach, I actually started because I feel bad for them, because it really makes them feel sick.
Oh.
When I cook spinach, it's very easy for me just to not cook some of it, and then they can eat that.
That's very kind of you.
That's okay. Yeah, I know. I'm so nice. I'm such a good mother.
So I actually wanted to talk to you about, like, I know that Noma did a couple of pop-ups, right? And so there was one in Mexico where the whole family went, right? In Japan as well.
Yes.
Did you guys all go to Japan too?
Yes. We've gone as a family for all of them.
What's that like with new food, new place, new culture? How do the kids take to that? How do you take to that?
You know, the kids are amazing. I mean, I think they're just so open. And I think often probably the kids, they look at their parents and see how they feel. And like, I fell in love with Tokyo immediately.
Yeah.
Renee was already in love with Tokyo, but it was my first time going to Tokyo.
Tokyo is amazing.
Pretty funny, right? Going to Tokyo for the first time, it's like, oh, right, I'm going to be here for 4 months. I think the variety of food and things that you can get in Japan is just, it's massive. So the girls, they love rice like so many other kids.
Yeah.
Eggs, good. All these, like, fried foods, like with the gyozas, and, like, it was very easy for them. to find things to eat. I mean, they weren't super into like natto and like these like kind of smelly fermented things.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fish was amazing. It was very easy to have them. We got to stay at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel, which is where the pop-up was. Yeah. And honestly, to stay there for 4 months in, you know, a very beautiful room and all this stuff without the possibility to cook.
Oh,
that was the worst part, actually.
So you went 4 months without cooking.
Yes.
That must have been tough.
Even though the breakfast buffet and all this stuff, it's amazing. But, you know, sometimes you just want to make something yourself.
I get
it. So, I mean, honestly, eating out and room service every day for 4 months, that's a long time.
Yeah. Wow. And so, but I'm guessing Mexico must be completely the opposite, no?
Yes. So in Mexico, we had this like house on the beach and we went to the market every day. Wow. Or we took produce from, you know, the stuff that Noma got and cooked at home every day. It was amazing. It was incredible. I think that eating and food is the best way to understand other cultures. It's something that's so, you know, graspable. It's so easy. And I think experiencing different and new cultures through food, it's like the most amazing thing.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, definitely. So you have to come back here and we have to feed you and take you to all the different...
A lot more.
So I'm going to ask you some fun things before we get to the really serious last question of mine. You know, you get a lot of famous chefs to your home that you cook for. So when was the last time that you were really nervous when a guest showed up?
I mean, honestly, the most nervous I have been was when I cooked for Rene the first time.
Tell me about that.
I thought that I had, you know, said, oh, you know, this day, I'll cook that day when you don't go to work. And like immediately regretted it when I had said it. I was like, oh my God, what did I get myself into? You know, and it was a strange feeling for me because I've always been very confident, like cooking for any other friends. Like, yeah. It's totally good. I know I'll impress you. So I thought about what I would cook for Renee, and I decided to cook something that I had made 1,000 times. And I wanted to cook something that would impress him. So I decided to cook a dish from my childhood. Mm-hmm. It's a Portuguese dish with chicken livers and like spicy tomato sauce that you serve on pasta with parsley. I'd made this thing 1,000 times. I could do it with my eyes closed. But I've always used like tinned tomatoes to make it. So, you know, I'm going there, I'm shopping, and then I'm standing there looking at these tinned tomatoes and I'm like, oh my God, I can't bring tinned tomatoes into his house. Like, what will he
what
think
is he
of
gonna
me?
Say?
Yes, exactly. So I panicked actually and I didn't think it through. So I bought the nicest, like horrible tomatoes that I could find. It was winter time in Denmark.
Yeah.
Like not good tomatoes. So I go, I'm cooking in his kitchen. He's like, oh, do you need any help? I'm like, no, go away. Just stay away. I chop up these tomatoes and I put them there. And like the second I did, I was like, oh my God, I just messed it up. I should have made a sauce out of the tomatoes first, obviously. So, you know, I messed it up. You know, I had to serve the dish to him the way that I didn't want to do it by saying like, so usually this is much better. So then I told him my little story with the tinned tomatoes and he thought it was very cute. So, I mean, I guess actually that should actually have been seal the deal pasta. I cooked for him first, actually. But yeah, so I learned a very good lesson there was that, you know, no matter who you're cooking for, just do it the way that you like it. That's the most important thing. If you cook it the way you like it, then, you know, it'll be fine. And then, you know, also obviously being married to Renee, just knowing that how much I think chefs in general who spend so much time in kitchens and spend so much time cooking for other people, they generally love just having someone cook like a home cooked meal, something that's a little different from what they eat.
And then when you go out to eat, what is it that, you know, like, I mean, you've probably eaten at every restaurant in the world. What is it that, you know, something that really stays with you? Do you enjoy the fine dining experience or do you prefer to, you know, go for something that's more comfort?
I think, I mean, now that I have, it depends also, like, is it me and Renee going out for dinner or all of us going out. I kind of like not spending like 4 or 5 hours. Like, I think, you know, sometimes for me, it's too long between the dishes at fine dining restaurants. And it's not because it's good, but I just get like restless. I almost get stressed on their behalf. It's like, why is this taking so long? Is there something wrong? But, you know, I just want to eat something that I think tastes really good.
Yeah. So that's
and
you
somewhere
go for,
you feel comfortable.
Usually when I end the conversation, I have like this one question that I ask all my guests, but it goes like, you know, what is the big dream? What is the big picture? And when I was thinking about you, I was like, what am I going to ask her? Because, you know, like you have, you know, best restaurant in the world several times over. And, but what is your big dream?
For me, my big dream, honestly, is to travel like 6 months of the year and be in Copenhagen 6 months of the year. I would love to leave this place every winter and just not ever see it in the winter again. I would love to spend like 3 months in Mexico every year in some hacienda, relaxing, just being, getting very close as a family, intensely with the kids, and then travel, like decide, okay, so we're going to go 3 months to India and we're going to travel all over. And then let's do Thailand or let's do Korea. That would be amazing.
That sounds like a pretty good dream to me. And now I'm going to put in one last question. Promise.
Yes.
If you had to give your daughters any advice, any life advice, what would you tell them?
Oh, this is going to sound so...
cliche?
So cliche. But honestly, don't be afraid. I mean, do everything that you do for you. I mean, and for your family, obviously. Don't be like a horrible, selfish person. But don't let fear of what others will think of you hold you back from doing anything.
Perfect. I'm going to take that advice as well. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Nadine on No Sugarcoat. Next week is my last episode for season one of my show. And I'm chatting with legendary food critic Rashmi Uday Singh about her time in the income tax department, her restaurant review system, and how to use Instagram.
No Sugarcoat is a Made in India production. This episode is produced by Sharanya Subramanian, edited by Soundman. Studio setup by Apoorv Isaac, a.k.a. Lala. Sound equipment by Artiste Studios. Our theme music is Rhythm Maker by the band Haiku. For more information, check out madeinindia.in.